You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with David Vermilion. David, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I'd love to know what your current project is. I know we're going to talk about curating as well, but I'd love to hear about what your current project is and perhaps how it relates to that practice.
So the piece I'm working now is called Echo and Narcissus, and it's a sound video interactive work that is meant to approach interactivity in a way that is normally not done or has not been done by most artists. Most artists who do interactive work is you move your body, your hand, or touch a keyboard, and what you see on the screen or projected has a direct relationship in some way to the type of movement you made. And I call that sort of a mirrored interface, that it's a one-to-one interface. And what Echo Narcissus does, it's sort of a pun on interactivity in that, of course, Echo and Narcissus don't communicate. So it's sort of playing with this idea of disrupting the interactive dialogue in a traditional interactive work of art. So there's two parts of the piece. There's a sound part that was... the text is written by L.A. poet Terry Wolverton, and it's meant to be a very sort of female perspective of sort of Echo's voice, and I gave her very little instruction on how to do it. I wanted to see just what she came up with. So that's the female voice. And then the male part is a tank of water. It's about 5-inch deep tank of water, with a projector underneath, and when you walk up to that tank, you see your image as seen through an Xbox Kinect, and as you move around, the image changes and mutates into different forms as you interact with the work. And then if you put your finger in the water, it's a touch table, and that will also alter your image and also alter the background. And so, and then with the echo part, I'm adding a section where if you get really close to a speaker, there'll be an array of speakers in the new version, that one speaker that you're near will whisper to you a whole different set of text that will in some ways maybe even be more seductive. And the main reception I want the piece to have at the beginning is when you walk up to it, you don't know it's interactive at all, that there's no clue, that basically what you think you're seeing is a sound video installation, and that through interacting, you discover it's interactive and not know walking up to it that it's meant to obey your command.
That's really interesting, and I've seen the video, of course, of the beginning of that project on your website. The technology you're using also sounds really interesting. You're using an Xbox Kinect, if I understood correctly, which is kind of an open source code now. I mean, that's really kind of fascinating. I haven't seen that used in artistic projects, and I'm sure it's happening, but that's a typical consumer Xbox Kinect. And you're altering that or changing how that's reading images?
Yeah, there's a whole set of open source most of the artistic projects that are now using the Kinect are using one of two platforms. They're using either a programming language called Processing, which is Java-based, or a programming language called Open Frameworks, which is C++. And they have ready-built libraries to set up the Kinect. You don't have to do anything. Or you can use the Microsoft system. But right now it's written in Processing, and I'm in the process of rewriting it in Open Frameworks because it's faster. And so, it's fairly easy. You don't have to do anything to the Kinect. It just plugs in. You have to use the old Kinect with Macs, which is what I'm using. But if you want to use the new Kinect, you have to use Windows. But, it's It's pretty established now, and most, like I said, most of the works you're seeing are utilizing that have switched from video cameras. That's how it used to be done with infrared video cameras. Now everyone's using the Kinect because it's got a pre-built system for finding your skeleton and knowing where your body parts are.
It's fascinating, and also, and you know, I like the idea of Narcissus and Echo as ideas as well as what the image creates, because it seems to speak to interactivity in a way. You know, when we come upon an installation that is, you know, quote unquote interactive or participatory, there's some kind of instructions. And this way, just as, you know, Narcissus discovered his image, we're discovering our image and the ability to interact with it, which is really kind of lovely. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and what's the important sort of part of the interaction is it gets disrupted. So instead of being a true mirror, your image, at some point you recognize that it is you, but at other times it may slow down, it gets distorted. If there's another person where there's two connects, where there could be two people interacting with it, I may switch the people. So, and then in the myth, Narcissus's image, as he gets older, slowly disappears. And eventually when he dies, towards the end, his image totally disappears. So that'll be part of the narrative of the piece. So there will be sort of a trajectory of a narrative as you interact with it. And again, the idea is that you are influencing the image, you're not in control of the image. It's sort of the idea of the narcissist part. And the other thing that's interesting about the myth that we always forget is Narcissus doesn't know what an echo is. It didn't exist, you know, mythologically before. So he's hearing his voice being repeated, and he's never been a cave and heard an echo. So it's kind of we have to always remind ourselves that the strangeness of what's happening to him is extra strange compared to when we go into we know what an echo is and what its physics is. Physical. Yeah.
I like that, and so that's a work that in a way tells the listening audience and myself a good amount about where you are in terms of your range of work. So I know there's, you know, sculptures and photography and a number of other things. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about also how you're curating. I want to talk a little bit about your curatorial history. But was your history as a curator also affected by this particular piece? And can we use it as a jumping off point?
Yeah. So I work in a very special gallery. It's called the Beale Center for Art and Technology at UC Irvine. And we're one of the maybe two or three spaces in the United States that shows what we call new media, but I like calling media art, or we're still trying to sort of figure out a different word, because I don't really believe in new media, because ultimately whatever we see that's driven by a computer gets turned into traditional media. So that's why it's really important, like I said, when you walk into the piece, you think it's traditional media. You think it's a sound video, I mean, more contemporary traditional media, but we all know that video art is sort of part of traditional media now. So you see it as a sound video piece. So when I came to the Beale 10 years ago, we showed really traditional interactive work. You did something, you would trigger something that would create sounds or an image. And even as I started curating, I showed that kind of work. And then it sort of got to a point. I did two shows 1 year, one by Golden Levin and one by Victoria Vesna. And Golden Levin is more of a traditional interactive artist, at least the works we showed in this exhibition. And they were all pretty much a mirror. The interactive works were more very much about mirror interface. And the room was filled with activity. People were really enjoying themselves. And what I became interested in calling is sort of the feeling of the space was sort of hyper interactivity. But people were engaged. They were really enjoying themselves. And then I showed Victoria Vez's work, which was more meditative. There was only 3 works instead of like 7 works. And her main interactive piece called Zero Wave Function was, even though it still mirrored your movements, in order to interact with what was a buckyball, basically, you had to move really, really slowly. So it was against the sort of idea of moving fast and moving slowly, and so it became a more embodied experience. And so this idea of embodiment becomes a very strong interest of mine now in my curatorial practice and clearly in the Echo and Narcissus piece. And so that's sort of where I'm taking that practice. And then at the same time, I'm exploring our show in the spring is going to be on synthetic biology and will be our second show that deals with what we call wet media. So there's dry media that's computational based, and then there's now a new genre called wet media, which includes bioart, and that's a new area that I'm exploring, which I've done one other show by the artist Paul Bonus, who was a pioneer and one of the pioneers in bioart. So I have a very wide, and I have a lot of freedom at the Beale to really do what I want to do, and I've really taken advantage of that over the years.
Who is that artist that you're mentioning that's a pioneer in bio art?
Paul Bonus.
Very good. Tell me a little bit about him, because I don't know his work.
So Paul Bonus, he started out as a net artist in the 90s and an early net artist. And then he became interested in bio art, and he was working, as I remember, with Critical Art Ensemble, who are another one of the pioneers of bioart. And the exhibition we showed had these 2 main works. Basically, he's the first work, which is the older one, he's been drawing with DNA. So he actually is able to put the certain enzymes into the bands of DNA and draw things like copyright symbol, skull and crossbones, 0 and 1, and we literally, in the gallery every week, we had to redo the experiment to get these different drawings. And the other piece he did, which I'm trying to remember the name.
I remember some of those pieces that were exhibited at MoMA years ago in a show about bio art. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, and the other main piece he said that's related to this drawing that's sort of about the politics of DNA and the philosophical point that the way DNA was presented to the court system was it is a fingerprint, but in fact it's not. And so what he has done, and I think he finally got it to work, he took the DNA from the O.J. Simpson trial and using his own DNA drew it to look exactly like all the DNA from he faked his DNA to look like all the DNA strands from the O.J. Simpson trial to show that DNA is a chemical process that's not purely like a fingerprint, which is which is an index. You know, you can't manipulate a fingerprint. You know, it is what it is. It's not a chemical process. So it's a very interesting approach to looking at the whole politics, because he's not just interested in the visual aspects, but also in the conceptual aspects of DNA and its use in the courts.
It's very interesting. And let's talk a little bit about, go back a little bit with the beginnings of your work, your curatorial history.
So,
Does that begin with the Beale Center in 2008, or were you curating before that?
No, my curating basically started in 2005 at the Beale. And before that, I was trained as a photographer, and I actually studied with one of the people you've interviewed, Judy Fiskin, was one of my instructors as an undergraduate. And And then around 1990, I decided that I didn't want to do photography anymore. I was sort of not so much bored, but felt like I really knew the history. I knew the technology, and I just didn't think I could do anything more with it than I was doing. So I started working just with sort of digital imagery for about, for a period of time. And then we moved to Minneapolis, and my wife was director of education at the Walker Arts Center, and I met Steve Dietz, who is one of the pioneering curators in new media, who also came from photography, and we became really good friends. And that's when I sort of retooled myself. I taught myself programming. I went way beyond Photoshop and sort of Illustrator in that sort of early period, and that sort of gave me the tools. But it took a while because this was still in the 90s that led me to this job. At the Beale was just the sort of probably it's sort of that, I guess, that 10,000 hours of teaching I needed before I started curating that I needed to both do this next level of work and be knowledgeable enough to curate in an intelligent way. And I've been fortunate because I've been able to do a lot of shows. So I've been able to have a lot of practice at the process of showing this kind of work, because usually curators do, like in a regular museum, do a show every couple of years. And I do two a year. I've done up to three a year. So it's kind of crazy.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of work. Has curating those shows and also being a practicing artist affected the way you approach your work or projects?
The biggest way I would say when I can find the time to do my own work is it's teaching me how to collaborate. I never collaborated before I did the Echo and Narcissus piece. And so having been a curator and having to manage projects and multiple people and learning how to communicate from being a solo artist to being, working with an artist, sometimes I'm actually collaborating with the artist. With Victoria Vesna, we collaborated on a piece together as in part of the show, and she's very open in how a curator communicates and exchanges ideas, and not all artists are like that. So I think I really started being a collaborator is a skill, and being able to do it, and I mean deep collaboration. I don't just mean asking someone to be a technical person to help you, and so I think that's what, and especially project managing. When I was doing my Echo and Narcissus piece, I literally had 6 months to do it, and it took 3 months to come up with the idea, so I had 3 months to actually make the work, and I could never have done that, I don't think, and managed the people and the schedule and all the things that had to go into making it if I hadn't had the experience of curating.
That's very interesting, because it's also at a time when, artist curators is something that's in the last 10 years gained more momentum. Do you think it's correct to say that before then there wasn't a lot of artist curators, and I suppose there's more now, but initially it seemed that those weren't two fields that easily went together?
Well, actually, I like to think of the Beale as in the tradition of an artist-run space. And in the 70s and 80s, a lot of the artist-run spaces, especially with video art, because video art wasn't being shown in museums, so a lot of times the artists would self-curate or exhibitions together in these artist-run spaces. So I think this is a natural thing that comes out of a medium that's exploring new areas that's being ignored by traditional galleries and museums. And so it's sort of, I think that's part of, so for a long time, you're right, there wasn't a lot of artist curators, but because video art had been accepted and was in major museums starting in the late 90s during the recession and in the 2000s, a lot of artist-run spaces disappeared because they didn't have the funding they needed. So so that it sort of went out of people's memory that artists did curate at one point a lot more. And so that's sort of the model that, in, since I come out of my, I was in, I come out of my undergraduate was in the 70s, so I was around during, like, in L.A., the early days of L.A. contemporary exhibitions, and there were, like, maybe five alternative artist-run spaces in L.A. During the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that was an exciting time, and it certainly brought us everything today in L.A. In closing, I'd like people to be able to come see your show if they're in the area. Can you tell us a little bit about how to get to your show and where it is?
Where the Beale Center is?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's at UC Irvine, which is University of California, Irvine. It's in the art department, the Claire Trevor School of the Arts. And our exhibition in the fall is called Objects of Wonder. And it's objects that sort of operate kind of like the Age of Wonder, where artists and science was sort of mixed up. And so the objects have a kind of art sci look to them. And some of them are based on a group of artists that work in what's called speculative design. And then there's an exhibition in the winter spring, which we also have a call that's up right now at the website.
A call to artists that's up on the website. You mean?
Yeah, a call to the website that's Beale Center, BEALL. Center at UCI.edu, and it is a call for a total of a 3-week residency to do a synthetic biology piece that will be in the exhibition, and the exhibition is called Traces of Vitality, and I'm co-curating the Objects of Wonder with Madeline Schwartzman, and I'm co-curating the Traces of Virtuality with Jens Hauser. And so there'll be the piece that we sort of commission that will be in the exhibition, and then we're going to pick two or three other artists to be in the exhibition.
And where is your Echo and Narcissus piece going to be?
Nowhere right now. I'm in the process of reworking it and trying to raise money to do the next version of it. So hopefully people just keep track on my website when it will be shown, and it's just, we'll see. It's a major endeavor to get it shown. I shown it at the ArtSci Gallery at UCLA, and I had it up in our gallery during, the Beale Center, we have an expressive robotics camp that we do on using art STEM curriculum. So I had the kids in the camp interacting with the work. And that's another thing I have to do a lot more, is sort of testing it and seeing how people respond to it. So hopefully there'll be a point where I'm looking forward to showing it again when I've done this new version.
Well, I look forward to that. David, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.